Michael Parker and D Program on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, that was a pretty intense hour we just had, and had to take a minute to get my head together. In this hour, I'm going to be joined by Jeremy Adams. As I've said in the past on the show, my mother was a teacher. She taught special education, and she taught to learning disabled children. And, you know, we were out in the middle of nowhere, West Texas, as the Australians call the bush, and that's where we were. That's where I grew up. Anyway, my mom did it, and she found a great deal of reward in that work, and I admired her for doing it. And these days, I kind of have mixed opinions, mixed feelings about teachers sometimes, especially when it comes to the union and thing. But I don't know if there's any occupation that knows more about our contemporary youth than teachers. And we're going to speak to one right now. He's only got a little while to be with us, so we're going to skip news stories. We're going to cut straight to the chase. And Jeremy Adams is the author of Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. My mother was also a special ed teacher, so we have that in common.
Wow, that's interesting. And when I would look at my mom, because where I was, we only had one school in the whole town. That's how small our community was. And so, you know, when I would see what she was doing, because we're in the same school, and when I was in junior high, that's where she was teaching. Sometimes I would just think, Mom, I don't know how you're doing it. But it makes me proud of her.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, both of my parents were teachers. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that, you know, your mother was special ed, but you also saw her teaching. I actually had my dad as my ninth grade English teacher. And let me tell you, that was a real interesting experience.
I can imagine. Mildly.
But, you know, my dad, to be perfectly honest, though, was an extraordinary teacher. He's one of these kind of what I call kind of teacher celebrities. You know what I mean? Yes. Like, you go out to dinner and everybody's like, oh, it's Mr. Adams. You know, my son had you 25 years ago. But, you know, what's interesting is I wrote a piece about my father just passed away in September. And I was thinking about him a lot. And one of the saddest things is he changed so many lives. But let me tell you something. My dad, for all of the wonderment and the awe that he evoked in the classroom, he could not make it a week. Nowadays, there's absolutely no way in the kind of modern school culture, the way that the kids behave, the expectations that we have for teachers, the climate, there's no way my dad wouldn't even let people chew gum or wear a hat, much less have a kid who can cuss him out in class, and then you can't kick him out of the class, and you're supposed to have a little circle and talk it out at that moment. I mean, my dad absolutely wouldn't make it nowadays.
Which part of the U.S. are you in, and where did you grow up?
I'm actually from the Central Valley of California. So, yeah, the really kind of ugly part. So no beaches, no mountains. I'm in the Central Valley, so I'm in Bakersfield. So it's hot, like real hot. Bad air, lots of crime, lots of poverty. That's where I'm teaching.
And I did know that, and I forgot. I apologize. I talked to so many people, and because Bakersfield, okay, man, it's like a great country music came from there. So, let's talk about this.
Well, let me just say, thank you for knowing that. So many people, all they know about Bakersfield is, yeah. Well, so many people don't know about Buck Owens and the Bakersfield sound. Everybody just thinks that, you know, Johnny Carson making fun of us was our claim to fame. So thank you for recognizing that. I appreciate that.
I'm a full-blown music geek, and the Bakersfield sound, I mean, Dwight Yoakam, probably the most famous modern progenitor. No, this is the great stuff. I don't ever curse on the show, but sometimes I wish I did, because I it's a one way of it showing my excitation at these subjects. But we'll get back on track here. Let's talk about schools, because right now, I mean, I never considered being a teacher, but in the realm of things, I've told people, and I probably said it on the show before, it's like, even when I was growing up, or especially in my 20s and things, I'd already made my decision, but I was just like, wow, I could never be a teacher, because, and I applaud you for doing it, because I'm like, white, straight guy, man, they might come for you. You know, it's like, so I applaud you being able to hang in there and do it. I wouldn't have been able to.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, one of the, you know, one of the interesting things about teaching as long as I have, I mean, I know that, I know I look like I'm 25 years old, but I'm really 46.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and I'm starting my 25th year next Monday. That's my first day of meetings back. Or as my students like to say, a quarter of a century, which feels a lot longer than just 25 years, by the way. But you know, the reason that you know, you hit the nail on the head right there, which is when you are in the classroom, you kind of notice things, I think, a little faster than the rest of the culture does. You know, you start to realize, hold on, that's different, and that's different, and that's weird, and that's peculiar, or that's interesting. And so about 5 to 7 years ago, my students really began to change in radical and colossal and profound and titanic ways that I feel like most Americans aren't really aware. Like, they're just kind of starting to get their pulse on it now. And you know, one of the things is when you write a book like Hollowed Out, and you're like, it's a warning, you know, you get people on the left who will say, oh, well, he's just a fuddy-duddy. He's just a crank. He's just a curmudgeon. Every generation thinks the next one is bad. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm desperately worried about my students because something qualitatively different is happening here. And let me describe it a little bit. I mean, I wrote a whole book about it, but the number one thing is our young people are desperately unhappy. We're talking about the most unhappy Americans in our entire history. The word that we hear all the time in the classroom is anxiety. We hear about record highs of hospitalization, self-harm, suicide. You know, even the New York Times is starting to understand how bad young people feel about their own lives. There was an article about 4 months ago, the fact that the ERs, like emergency rooms all over America, these doctors don't know what to do because these teenage girls who have so much anxiety and are on the verge of self-harm are checking themselves and going into ERs because they feel so bad about themselves. And so there's something profoundly wrong going on with our children. And that's what the book is all about, is why they're literally hollowed out.
I have a daughter who's in college. I have a daughter who's in high school. It's going to be her senior year. And my daughters are, for the most part, pretty, I mean, they make good grades, they have good social lives, and they've turned out really well. But I do hear things that sometimes, you know, amongst their schoolmates or just through them, I hear what's going on in the culture. And you talk about this. What do you talk about some of the things they have trouble with, like patriotism and things like that. But what do you think is at the heart of the unhappiness, the unrewarded,
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a great question. I think let's answer it a different way. Think about all the things that you and I, growing up, we were taught that make our lives meaningful and purposeful and allow for, you know, what the Greeks used to call human flourishing. Love, faith, family, learning, friendship, intellectual and moral curiosity. You know, think of all the connective tissue that when you're young, you're told go out into the world, go participate in sports, go read books, go make friendships, go fall in love, go date, go to the movies. And all of those things that kind of give you a sense of the enormity of the world and the possibilities of your life and a sense of grandeur and enchantment. Take all those things, Michael, and remove them from the life of young people, and they're not going to be very happy. Young people are the loneliest generation. 1 in 5 millennials don't have a good friend in the entire world. In the last year, we have seen that marriage rates in America are at all-time lows. A lot of millennials have more interest in having a dog than in having a child. They are the least patriotic Americans by far. And obviously, not only are they not religious, which, again, that's none of my business if you're religious, but they are deeply ignorant about religion. I mean, a lot of my students have no idea what the resurrection is. They just see religion as something that is judgy and intolerant and is there to condemn them and make them feel bad. So if you take away God and country and friends and family and learning and going out into the world and watching movies, I mean, they don't read books. And so that's, you know, that's what's hollowing them out. And of course, I don't want anybody out there to think that I'm blaming the kids. It's our fault. I mean, we have created a world.
Absolutely.
We have created a world where they can be isolated, where they can be on their phones 9 hours a day, where we try and be their friends rather than trying to be their fathers and their you know, their teachers. And so we have created this situation for them. And I wrote the book as a kind of a battle cry for guys, this is bad. It's going to get worse. And we've got to do something about it. So, yeah, I mean, I think young people are growing up without adults in their lives. And, you know, I know it's very fashionable to say, well, young people, let's just have empathy and grace and you're great as you are. You're perfect. No, you're not perfect as you are. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you're a kid. You need to be mentored. You need to be taught. You need to have an exemplar. You need to have, somebody has to teach you standards. So we adults have got to start adulting again.
And yeah, I'm certainly not blaming the kids, and we've certainly not done a great job. We are in ourselves also a work in progress, and civilization is a work in progress. And we go through these phases where I think we get the wrong ideas. And certainly we've come through a lot of them, and looks like we're headed towards some more. My hope is that we will regain our senses at some point. Unfortunately, the people that take the brunt of all that are our kids. And even with my own daughters, who are super intelligent and pretty well adjusted, I mean, they think daddy is kind of a wild and crazy,
Same here. Yeah. Yeah.
God, I mean, I have a daughter. Patriotism?
I know. Well, I mean, I'm glad that I'm not the only one. I mean, I wrote the book about my students, but you know, a lot of this is also things that I experienced in my own home with my own children, my own failings as a dad. And the thing that really, really bothers me, is, you know, you look at this generation of young people, and from an objective standpoint, they have more to be happy about and more to be thankful for than any human beings on the face of the planet. They're more free, that we are more tolerant, more wealthy, more healthy. We have, you know, more opportunity and freedom than we can ever imagine. And yet they really are the most unhappy generation. And frankly, they don't have a lot of, you know, adulation for the people who gave them this extraordinary world. You said something I thought really smart and intelligent a minute ago. You said, you know, we have some bad ideas out there. Well, I think the number one bad idea out there is that people think that freedom is all about the freedom to be free from any responsibility or connection, that I don't have to do anything. No, that's wrong, folks. Freedom, as the founding fathers understood it, freedom allows you to connect yourselves to whatever you want to connect to in life to make your life meaningful. You choose who to marry. You choose where to live. You choose what God to worship. That makes your life meaningful. Young people have confused freedom to mean I don't have to connect to anything. I'm free from everything. And that's a bad idea, and it's toxic, and it's hollowing them out.
You were the right person to have on in the third hour, because I talk about these things a lot. And let me just throw one other personal anecdote. I'm very proud of my daughters, and my wife does a great job. So a lot of this is credit to her. But you know, I grew up in Texas. My wife grew up in Australia. And you know, my daughters, people would always say, all of our friends, because even though we're on the older side, we were kind of the first amongst our crew to have kids. And they'd always look at my daughters and say, Michael, Anna, your daughters are so well behaved. And, you know, they just do, you know, and then when the others started having kids, my daughters would kind of look out for the younger kids. And I'd always be pleased and flattered to hear that. But what I noticed was some of these other people, their kids didn't come along as well. And yet I'm the old fuddy-duddy, you know, and I was never that hard on my kids, but there's lines and there's expectations and there's parameters, and you're my daughters and this is the way we're going to do things. I'm not going to have a little talk with you. The talk is going to come from me and you're going to listen. Okay. And so I think that kids need a certain degree of, you know, you got to show them, these are the boundaries. We're not going beyond that. We're not going beyond that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You said it very, very well. And I would say that, you know, we have this notion, this almost kind of weird obsession with youth these days, where we celebrate youth and youth values and youth in our commercials. And young people are the ones leading the way on race relations and education reform and criminal justice reform. No, I don't want a 15-year-old who doesn't know anything thinking like, you know what term I can't stand is when they're like, do the work. It's like, don't tell me to do the work. You haven't read any of the books you're supposed to have read. And so there's a whole chapter in my book about this that it's one of my favorite ones, where I talk about that in this generation, you have the death of what I call the family meal. You know, I mentioned, the family meal about five or six years ago in my class. I said, you know,
we've been guilty of that too. And I feel bad about it, but you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, and the students don't even know what I'm talking about, by the way. This tradition of like once a day you come together as a family, you talk, maybe you fight, you talk about whatever, you eat together, you used to pray together, you clean up together. that connective tissue is just not there. And I ask my students, again, this is a good example of where you kind of see things a little earlier than everybody else. I said, well, what do you guys do all night? They said, well, I get my food and I go to my room and my parents sit in front of the TV, or my parent, I have one parent and they work two jobs. See, and that's another thing I'm trying to get people to understand here, is that a lot of our young people only spend time with other young people, right? They're on their devices 9 or 10 hours a day. They're watching videos from other young people, and human beings learn by example, right? We need exemplars before us. And if we don't have that, then all we do is absorb a youthful, infantile, immature worldview, way of looking at things, way of communicating. And you know this, you know why they're so dang anxious, is because these kids are on all the time. They're on at school. And then when they go home, they have their devices. And if there's a beef with a friend or they're fighting with a teacher, whatever, it follows them home. So there's never a chance to just decompress, much less decompress with a family member who loves you and supports you.
Jeremy, I know we only have you for 30 minutes. I have to take a quick break. It's an ad break. When we come back, I've got some questions for you about how you teach, since we've got these special class of citizens that we're now dealing with. This is TNT. I speak with Jeremy Adams, and we'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Joseph Arthur.
Pelosi tiptoed around the issue of U.S.-China relations Friday as she wrapped up her swing through Asia, knocking Beijing's human rights record before insisting in the next breath that America had to work with its superpower rival. I have said it again and again, if we do not speak out for human rights in China because of commercial interests, we lose all moral authority to speak out about human rights any place in the world, she told reporters during a news conference. Well, statements like this certainly don't calm the situation between these big junkyard dog nations, and they're probably not meant to. Whatever righteous explanations she can make about her reasons for going to Taiwan, they cannot really justify the minefield we have now stepped in as a nation. It all just seems an unnecessary complication. You pick your battles, and we can hardly justify being world police with our country in the state that it's in. Claiming a moral high ground strikes me like a bit much. And the way that it's going, we don't have the resources on any level to really contend with this right now. Spiritually, mentally, physically, financially. Chaos closing in on every angle and at every level.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Government faked a pandemic. Government faked a test. Government faked a cure. Government must be held accountable. There's nothing fake about us. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I speak with Jeremy Adams, and in the bio materials that I get about Jeremy, it says that he is the California Teacher of the Year. So clearly the man knows what he's doing. Jeremy, you're talking about the special kind of situation and frame of mind that our youth are in now. As a teacher, how do you get across to them? I'm guessing you're not the kind of guy to dumb it down. So how do you get them to relate to you and to listen to you and learn?
You know, I've done so many of these interviews, and you're the first one to ever ask me about kind of my teach. Like, how do I personally teach? And if I'm being perfectly honest, I feel like we're kind of going on the couch right now psychologically. You know, I feel like I'm not as good as I used to be. And I feel like it's not, it's not because the pitcher is any different. I feel like it's like the catcher is different. It's like the students don't have the same sense of humor they used to have. You've got to be very careful about what you say in class. You know, I don't broach sensitive subjects. And you know, the number one thing is I have gotten to a point where I will not allow any phones in class anymore. You know, you used Excellent. To be kind of, okay, you know, yeah, I mean, you can have them on the desk if you need them, da, da, da. No, you know, this year, I don't want anything in your ear. I don't want anything on your desk. We're going to go back to like the 1980s when it comes to technology. And I want you, like, and I'm going to tell them on the first day next week, I'm greedy for your attention. I want you completely here because your brains are bifurcated all the time. How can you possibly learn the Federalist Papers? How can you possibly learn about, you know, the unitary theory of the executive or know the difference between an interest group and a political party when you are constantly feeling the buzzing on your phone, looking at your notifications? I mean, I'm guilty of this. I get, you know, distracted with my technology. And Me so, too. You know, yeah, I mean, we're all guilty of this, but our kids, especially so. And so, you know, I'm a very traditional teacher. I believe in, and I teach kind of the honors classes. So I'm very lucky with, you know, I get the kids who typically want to be there, but their attention span is destroyed. I don't know if you saw this. This is fascinating. About 2 weeks ago, I don't know if it was the New York Times or maybe a European magazine, but there's an article about how Netflix noticed that on all of their teenage shows, the subtitles were being read, right? And at first they're like, oh, this is great. The teenagers are reading now. No. What happened was the teenagers are holding onto their phone and they're watching a show and they just want to figure out what's going to happen in the scene really fast so they can go right back to their phones. I had students tell me last year, and I mean, I was floored. Mr. Adams, we don't watch movies. I'm like, what do you mean you don't watch movies? Movies are one of the great joys of life. They're like, we can't pay attention to it. I mean, I was watching Jurassic Park in June and teenagers were getting up and leaving because it wasn't enough stimulation for them. I mean, that's what we're dealing with in the classroom. No joke. That's what we're dealing with.
When you've had so many hits, you can't get a hit strong enough to keep your attention. Oh my God. Gigantic Spielberg dinosaurs is not enough visual stimulation.
It's not enough. And they can't just watch a show and watch the show. They have to be on their phones as well. I mean, you remember when we were kids, when you watch a movie in class, that was like a great day. Wow, we get to watch a movie. Kids are bored out of their minds. They would rather just give them their phones and let them kind of vegetate a little bit. So, you know, that's, you know, their attention spans are gone. And of course, if you can't pay attention, you can't learn, you can't grow. The magic and the majesty of education will never reach you. And again, that's a whole nother element of kind of being hollowed out intellectually.
Well, I like the idea of you telling them you can't have, so how's this going to work? You're going to tell them, okay, so turn the phone off, set it on the desk. How are you going to make this happen?
Well, actually, I tell a little joke. You know how, remember when you had little kids and you had to do potty training and you're like, okay, do you need to do number one or do you need to do number two? You know what I mean?
Yep.
Well, I tell the students, look, I if you need to go do number one, just get up and go. You don't need to tell me. You're almost adults. If you need to do number two, I see these, like the cell phone addiction as number three. Like if you have to, like if you absolutely have to look at it or make a call, fine, but don't do it in front of everybody else. Don't do it in class. Leave the classroom and do it. You know, go right outside the door and do it, which is kind of a way of not completely taking it away, but making sure that it's not on their desk and they're not distracted. So that's, every teacher's different, but that's how I think I'm going to handle it.
Well, that's an interesting idea because it also lets everybody know this person has got the shakes and can't stay away from their phone and is now going to have to go out the door to use it. So that's an interesting proposition.
Yeah. Or, well, you don't know why. I mean, somebody might be just going to the bathroom too. I mean, you never know, but the idea though is that, you know, you look at, you know, levels of deep focus and deep concentration. And I feel like, I don't know about you. I feel like I can't read a book as well as I could 20 years ago. I mean, I used to be able to sit down for 90 minutes and read a novel or read a political science book. And I find now I can go 25 minutes and I got to get up and walk around. I mean, I can't even imagine what the teenagers are going through.
Jeremy, thank you. I'm older than you, but I noticed that a long time ago with myself. And I'm like, man, what is wrong with me? I'm not, because when I was a kid growing up in the middle of nowhere, all we had was a library. There was no internet. There's no like cell phones or anything like that. We had three channels. We're on a farm, but the library was my jam. And I was a big science fiction head. So I would read constantly all the time. And I was a really good reader. But over the, over the years, even in as early as in my 20s, you know, I was like, well, wait a minute, my retention is not as good as it used to be. And these days, for the past 20 years, I've spent all my time like trying to read about every kind of brain enhancing, you know, binaural beats or you know, what kind of vitamins and food could I eat to get my brain back?
Well, you know, there's a lot more plasticity to the brain than I think we understood 20 or 30 years ago. And I think that those neural pathways can be really repaired. But you have to put in the work of putting in the focus. You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, I have such a romantic view of education. I mean, I really do believe that a high quality education is the key to a meaningful individual life. And also it's what makes the American dream possible. It is the widest, most certain door to the American dream, but it does take a lot of work. I mean, that when I talk about equality, you know, that's what I mean is that the American dream is for everybody. It's no matter what your background is, your race, your religion, how long you've been here, America is for you, but you have to work for the American dream. You have to work for success. And, you know, and I think somewhere along the way, you know, I think where we really changed the culture, and this is, man, this would be like another half hour conversation, but I'll tell you where I think we changed the culture is where power used to be through character and virtue and hard work. Now power comes through being aggrieved at a certain group. And I think that changed everything.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Jeremy, let me ask you this. Well, I don't know if you have another interview immediately booked, but you're welcome to stay. If you don't, I've got to take my bottom of the hour news break. Can you stick around or do you have to bail?
Yeah, one more segment would be great. Yeah, 50, I got it. Absolutely. 15 more minutes is good. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Okay, so we're going to take a very quick news break, and we'll be back with Jeremy Adams for just a little bit more. Thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. The Russian Foreign Ministry says that Ukraine's shelling of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is an act of terrorism that could trigger a disaster that would eclipse the 1986 Chernobyl incident. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has said the responsibility for the conflict in Ukraine lies with the Russian government and not its people, and therefore it is hard to imagine a complete visa ban for Russian citizens.
At TNT Radio, we never go home. We're committed to bringing you our take on the biggest topics of our time. We broadcast live 24/7 online globally. No matter what, we've got you covered on TNT Radio.
I speak with Jeremy Adams, and I'm lucky to have him on for one more segment. He is the author of Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. He's also one of California's Teachers of the Year. And at the top of the hour, I said, made this observation that I think teachers are our best lens to see what's going on with our kids. And do all of the teachers feel the way you feel? Because sometimes when I hear about, especially post-COVID, and I'm not trying to pick on teachers because clearly you're not of this mindset, because I have a lot of teachers on the show. But sometimes I feel like teachers, you know, well, you know, we don't want to go back to, we're waiting on certain things. That's how do many of your teacher cohorts feel the way that you feel about children and about your work now?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, to be perfectly honest with you, I notice a bit of a generational schism here. I think people who've been teaching for a while have noticed these things. And I think that we kind of, to a certain degree, have a kind of a different view sometimes of what teaching is. You know, I didn't go into the classroom to be an advocate. I'm not trying to, I don't have an, I mean, I, of course I have a political view. I'm probably, you know, I'm probably not as conservative as most of your listeners, even though I consider myself to be conservative, you know, but that's not, and my students know kind of where I am, but I'm not in there to advocate for a certain ideological perspective. And I think sometimes, you know, I do think that there is, we do kind of get a bad rap when people watch those videos of, you know, libs of TikTok and you see, you know, teachers saying all these zany things and, you know, I'm going to hide certain things from parents. And, or you listen to, you know, what happened in Virginia, where you had McCullough saying, you know, we don't need to listen to the parents at all. What are we talking about? So I think those things are out there, but I do think that there is a generational schism. And I think older teachers definitely see it. Younger teachers, I think, sometimes feel like, and again, this is a generalization, so it's not a universal principle at all, but I do think,
understood.
You know, I think there is sometimes a sense that we're supposed to be there emotionally for our students, that kind of the social emotional dimension, that we're kind of supposed to be, you know, act in loco parentis, that we're supposed to be kind of a friend, that we're supposed to be kind of a therapist. And again, you know, I'm a big believer in rapport. I think that having great rapport with your students is number one. I mean, that, no question about it. But I'm not there to be your dad or your friend or your therapist. That's not what I'm trained to do. And I think sometimes maybe a few younger teachers kind of have that sense sometimes on an equal footing with the academics. And I don't. I think my relationship is largely academic. It's personal, of course. I mean, I care about you and I want you to know that I'm here for you. But I'm only that so that I can educate you. Does that make any sense at all?
Absolutely. And I want to go back to a point that you made earlier. You were saying that, you know, your dad, you guys go to restaurants, everybody would flock. Hey, you know, you taught my son or daughter back in the day. In the little town that I grew up in, the most popular person, the most popular family in my little town, the dad was a coach and a great teacher, black. His son was a good athlete. His other son was a good athlete. But that was kind of beside the point. The main thing was, everybody just loved him. We all loved him. And Coach Childress, you know, it's like he was the, probably to this day, like the biggest celebrity in our town. And people loved him. And, you know, he didn't go out of his way to be a therapist and all those things that you're describing. He was just a good teacher. And you use the word rapport. That's all you need. Just some rapport and then do your job.
And by the way, something tells me that he was not the guy who let everything slide, who had no expectations, who had no standards, who just wanted to kind of joke around with the kids, who had a couch in the back of their room. Something tells me, when you think about the teachers who, if you're lucky enough to have had a teacher who changed your life, it is rarely a teacher who was just your buddy or your pal and you screw around. It's somebody who actually had you grow intellectually and morally, gave you a sense of what you could be, and then really motivated you to kind of bridge the chasm between what you can be and what you are. That's inspiring. That's what education is about. And so, you know, when I think about the teachers who made a difference to me, they were tough. They were hard.
Yes.
But they also knew they believed in me. And you can be both. And I think sometimes we kind of lose the thread on that duality there.
Well, it's a shame that you think that some of the younger teachers are seeing it differently, because the qualities that you just described, I'm thinking of like just a few of my favorite teachers that I had. They were damn tough. And yet we loved them because we knew, we respected them, and we knew that they cared about us. They cared enough about us to not put up with any crap. And you better study and you better listen and you better take some notes.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is kind of what I worry about in kind of a post-COVID educational system. I will tell you, last year was a really hard teaching year because in the year that the kids were away, they didn't have to turn on their cameras. They didn't have to turn in work on time. Many of them were pass fail. They could just skate on by. They thought, you know, open note tests for forever. And I think what happened last year was, you know, kids came back and they were still kind of in that mode that this is supposed to be easy. But you and I both know that you don't get anything out of an easy process, right? I mean, you don't have trophies for, you know, doing your laundry. And this idea that achievement, real authentic achievement, is the handmaiden of colossal effort, I think is lost on a lot of people. I mean, I think that, you know, what have we done? We have lowered these standards so low to almost everybody passes nowadays. A diploma in this country, I mean, what does it say that our graduation rates are skyrocketing, you know, and our reading and math scores are flat? I mean, that says something about the quality of the diploma. And I don't think that's helping anybody in the long run of their lives.
Jeremy, not to get political, but here's something that just I thought was laughable the other day. So California, and, you know, I came here from Texas and we talk about California a lot, but like California, our literacy rates and we're absolutely terrible. And then they took Gavin Newsom to D.C. and gave him some kind of an education honor or something. Do you remember, like, just a couple of weeks ago? I was like,
let me tell you something. I don't know if you know. I'm also a columnist for the Daily Wire, and I had a
column. I didn't know that.
One of the cool things about Hollowed Out doing pretty well when it was, you know, you kind of get these offers, and I just wrote a column that came out today about the number one kind of policy problem we have is literacy. And if you want to find something that's deeply disturbing, I'm going to disturb your audience right now. And it kind of ties into what you're saying about Gavin Newsom, right? So if you look at literacy rates as early as third or fourth grade, so we're talking about like 7 and 8 year olds, it's scary how well you can predict dropout rates, incarceration rates, income levels in the future, right? I mean, you tie it to early literacy, Well, guess what, Michael? 60% of Californian third graders are behind on literacy. And by the way, I don't want to hear anybody, my friends on the left, talking about anything other than literacy. If you're going to talk about equity, then talk about literacy. Because you know what? Illiteracy disproportionately affects poor kids and it affects people of color more than anybody else. If we're not willing to tackle that, then I don't think we're all that serious about bridging these gaps that are real and they persist. I mean, to me, the most magical thing in the world is having a student whose parents don't have much, but by God, they know that what we do in a classroom can be a catapult out of a bad situation. And you have to get them to read and to, reading is a gateway capacity. If you can do that, you can do anything. And so, in California, 60%, by the time they're 8 years old, we can predict that 60% are already going to have problems. I'm sorry, that's we don't talk about that enough. We need to.
It is not sustainable. It is not pro-human. And just the idea that we were going to give the guy an award for that, and it was some kind of an innovation in education. What are we innovating here? I don't see it. And to your point, like being able to predict behavior and dropout rates, yes, if a kid can't read, he's going to develop anxiety, anger, embarrassment. He ain't going to stick around.
Well, and not only that, reading to me is one of the great joys of my life. I read when I was at 18 years old, I read Tolstoy and I read the Sermon on the Mount. And I read, for the first time, I think I was in college when I really started to like, I'm going to read some of these books. And you know what reading does is it takes your really small world, because guess what? We're all small, right? We only got this brain and these eyes and we only live in this place. We all ipso facto have small lives, but reading, it opens up a universe of possibilities, right? And if you can't read, then your world's going to stay perpetually small. And I mean, that's a tragedy, especially for young people who are coming from a bad situation. They need to be inspired. And you're not inspirable if you don't have an attention span, if you're not eating with your family, if you're not going to church, if you don't love your country, if you can't read. I mean, this is what Hollerow is all about, is all these things come together and make it so it's harder and harder for our young people to achieve the American dream. And let's not even start talking about the fact that many of them don't even believe in the American dream. They think that it's a lie. They think it's a farce. They think that it's a fraud and a sideshow. That's the literacy is so important.
Is there anything, we're going to wind this down. Is there anything positive like that these kids, because I know they're as talented and smart as were. We're the same organism. Is there anything that they respond to positively besides their phones and talking to each other that we could utilize to perhaps work with?
I think that they're a very idealistic generation, by the way. I mean, I can give you, and I know that, I know we're all pretty conservative here, but there's a very optimistic spin on their environmentalism. I mean, they do believe that we can change the world. They don't,
and
they,
right.
they like to think, and they're right. They think globally, not kind of parochially. They don't know it, but they have a completely American view of justice. I mean, you go read John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and that's what they believe in. They just don't know it, right? So they have a thoroughly American view of the world. And the other thing I would say about them is that, they, for all of the kind of tearing down of statues and all the stuff that drives me crazy.
Me too.
I do appreciate the fact that some of them, and this is kind of a conversation I've had with my daughter, and I understand what she's saying. She's saying, look, we just want to be very clear that anything that has to do with, racism and sexism and oppression, we don't want anything to do with it. And if that means we got to change some names of some schools and stuff, then that's a small price to pay. So, it's not the way I would do, but I understand their perspective and it is idealistic. So, but let me just kind of say this before we end though. The solution has got to come with the adults. We cannot trust the kids to fix their own problems. And if we are not willing to put ourselves back into the moral, intellectual, and yes, physical, we've got to be around our kids more. If we're not willing to do this, none of these things are going to be, improved. And the hollowing out of this generation is going to continue.
Jeremy, this has been an absolute joy speaking with you. I love your passion.
Thank you.
The kids that get to learn from you are lucky. And I am sure, they're giving you awards. I'm sure they're responding to you and they know that you care and they feel your energy. And man, I thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I don't think there's a more important conversation than to have. one about our children in the future. So, Michael, thank you so much. This was great fun. Thank you so much. Hope I can come back someday. Thank you.
Oh, you can absolutely come back. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy Adams, he is the author of Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. He gave us an extra 15 minutes. We appreciate that. Thank you, Jeremy. We'll definitely be having you back, brother. All right, folks. So we're going to take a break here. And then when we come back, I'm going to do a little free form and I'm going to give you my thoughts on all of this. This has been a pretty intense show. I rarely get time to speak directly to you, but that's what's going to happen on the other side.
Anthony Fauci lied and people died.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Marano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Marano.
In a rewrite of history, Anthony Fauci is now claiming that he never recommended lockdowns in the United States.
I didn't recommend locking anything down.
That was Anthony Fauci in 2022, denying he had anything to do with lockdowns. But let's go to the audio. Here's Anthony Fauci in 2020.
I recommended to the president that we shut the country down.
Fauci saying I had nothing to do with it. Fauci admitting he actually recommended the lockdowns. And let us not forget, lockdowns killed. Delayed medical treatments, depression, loneliness, poverty increase, which causes higher death rates. Isn't it time for Anthony Fauci to come clean and admit his grave error on COVID-19? For the Marano Minute, this is Mark Marano on TNT Radio.
Too many people with diabetes don't have regular checks of their feet. What looks like a minor problem to anyone else can then escalate very rapidly to, the worst case, an amputation.
Generally, the signs or the symptoms that someone with diabetes should look for are just changes in their skin, so dry or they're getting cracks or more calluses.
Preventable foot problems can evolve quite rapidly. If they are also in the context of poor blood supply, what you find is that the infection takes hold and rapidly spreads throughout the foot and leg.
Understanding just simple things about how to cut your toenails correctly, the right footwear to wear so that that's not going to cause rubbing, but also so it can support your feet if you've got damage or weakness with muscles and joints. People should be visiting health professionals with regards to their foot care at least yearly.
Go to the doctor, watch your health, and look after your feet.
We can end diabetes-related amputations within a generation.
Interview conducted at 10:15. Present are Sergeant Jones, PC Clough, Mr. Wall, an uninsulated cavity wall, and his solicitor, Mr. Bent. Do you understand the charges?
I shall be speaking for Mr. Wall on account of him being a pile of bricks.
Right, you're accused of wasting energy, Mr. Wall, and we've got concrete evidence. We know that unfilled cavity walls are responsible for up to a third of all home energy wastage.
We also believe you're involved in a fencing operation.
We're going to throw the book at you.
Okay. Mr. Wall would like to say ouch.
It's criminal to waste energy. To find out how to save up to 25% off your heating bills, visit saveenergy.co.uk or call 0845 727 7200.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative, this is Viewpoint.
The lack of civilian access to working group meetings on the WHO pandemic treaty is a concern. Another is the degree to which the World Health Organization will no longer be making recommendations to member countries, but dictating to them. Astrid Stuckelberger, a scientist at the Institute of Global Health of the Faculty of Medicine of the University of Geneva and former employee of WHO, said in March 2021 that the 194 member countries are not voting on whether they agree on the pandemic treaty. Instead, they are legally bound to concede to its framework. This delegation put together to draft the pandemic treaty has been embedded in the constitution of WHO and is immediately approved by 194 member states, regardless of whether they adopt its principles. This delegation is legally binding according to the international health regulations.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
All right, folks. So it is our final segment today. And I want to thank all of our guests who came on today. It was a thoroughly enjoyable show, at least from my point of view. And Jeremy had to leave a little early, but he gave us an extra 15 minutes. So we appreciate that. And I'm going to let his publicists and people know that he did that. It was very generous. So this gives me a little chance to speak directly to you, which I rarely get to do. I do it sometimes in the news, but today I'm afforded that opportunity. And, you know, during that talk with Jeremy, he made the comment, and occasionally people make it to me through the shows, like they say, well, you know, maybe I'm not as conservative as my audience or as your audience or something like that. You know what? Actually, somebody asked me the other day, my dad was kind of asked me a question. And I said, Dad, do you think that I'm like a hard right, far right guy? And he kind of laughed. He was a little embarrassed. He goes, well, you know, you're a little bit more conservative than you used to be. And I'm like, well, yeah. I said, Dad, honestly, I think I'm just pretty middle of the road, man. I said, I'm just tired of nonsense. And I'm tired of pretending that this government overreach and this authoritarianism and just crazy insanity is happening. So if that makes me appear to be far right, or, you know, so be it. I don't think I'm that at all. I think I'm just, I have traditional values. And I don't think this is necessarily just an American thing. Clearly, our studios and our company is based in Australia. And I think a big point behind this whole TNT radio venture was to try to get back to some semblance of the truth and some semblance of normalcy and some, you know, law and order are good things. And at some point, we have to stop lying to ourselves and going along with this stuff. As Jeremy was talking about our kids, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is on us, not so much them. They are our offspring, and they are responding to the input that we give to them. And as we continue to lower the bar on things, as we continue to accept and comply with crazier and crazier ideas, with a DOJ and an FBI that's just off the hook secret police at this point, I would think that they would think, you know, why would I want to join the military? Why would I really want to put a flag up? Why would I want to believe in your nationalism, in your politics? Why would I want to believe in your religion? Which is not to say that they don't believe in good versus evil or something being better than the other, but we're certainly not being very clear about what we stand for. And that's one thing that we're trying to do here at this show and this network, is to be clear what we're against so we can get back to what we are for. And we have to call out the complete insanity that we're being surrounded with right now. And listen, I'm not completely anti-Democrat. That's a really overtly simple way of looking at it. But I do have to say that I think some of the worst ideas and the straight up authoritarianism that we're seeing, unfortunately, is coming from that side of the aisle. Now, I'll make a little admission. So in the early 2000s, I had a show, and at that point, I probably was more liberal than I am now, but I still feel like I feel about the same way now that I felt about most things. I'm just anti-corruption. I just want things to be fair. I want everyone to be treated equal. I'm not interested in your demographic. I'm not interested in your pronouns. I'm not interested in your race or your sex or your particular God. You're either cool or you aren't. You know, you're either a nice person or you're a jerk. And that's, you know, before we became obsessed with division, which really is a huge mind F that the people that are running the joint have been able to put upon us, when we were all just people and working our issues out, that things were better. And now this hyper focus on demographics and pronouns and all the rest of it, we talked about it ad nauseum, but that's truth. We need to just get back to being truth, just being people. And, you know, let's not play favorites on everything. Let's just treat people fairly. And let's also be able to admit, and media, I'm looking at you, because man, you guys are probably the worst offenders, because the politicians would not be able to do all this stuff if they were not allowed to do it. If they were not given cover by the legacy media, all of these outrageous, illegal acts by this total punk, Merrick Garland and Mueller before him, and let the Clintons get off for all the things that they did. And you know what, Obama, you're not off the hook either. Yes, you were the first black president. That's great. However, during your 8 years, I saw racism increase. You played favorites. You put things out there into the public that did not help the civil discourse. So, you know, we've all got a part to play in this. And Republicans, I'm straying from my original point. Early 2000s, I thought the Republican Party was just completely nuts. The war on terror, the whole, you're either with us or you're against us. I'm like, wow, could we be any dumber than that? Could we be any less critical of our situation that we're in, which is quite dire? Well, that was my big turnoff to the Republicans in the early 2000s. And so a lot of people thought I was a liberal. No, I wasn't really a liberal. I'm just a guy that's American and believes in truth. And let's take a minute and let's think about things before we act. You know, before you go and shoot your mouth off, let's stand back and look at this critically. But there's things at play here that were far more complicated than I ever thought. I suspected that there were things going on that I was not aware of, and I still see those things happening. And I see a lot of people, like people that I know, who still can't accept that these things are happening. So all they see is a red team and a blue team, and you got to be on one of the teams, right? Well, no, it's far more complex than that. Some of us share the ideals of both sides and more. Some of us don't like things about either one of them and more. We can walk and chew gum at the same time here, people. We can be critical, and we're going to have to be critical. And if you're cheering on the Mar-a-Lago thing because Orange Man bad, you know, I pity you because you're being really simplistic about this. And when I hear people talk about the Bush 2 administration and, you know, how 9/11 and all the things that we did as a result of that, man, that was a stain. That was a stain on the United States of America that killed God knows how many people of ours and started, what, $6, $7, $8 trillion worth of damage and destruction in the Middle East that we finally just turned and walked away from via the funeral home director, as our first guest called Joe Biden. So now we're in a pretty tough situation, and we're dealing with things that I didn't think the 21st century was going to look like. You know, the old joke, where's my flying car? Yeah, absolutely. Where's my flying car? Well, we don't have that, but we got some polio in the sewers. How do you feel about that? Well, I don't feel great about it. And I see people fighting more than they've ever fought. And that teacher, won a California Teaching Award, just told you that these young people that we're raising that have more than we ever had in the richest country in the world with more advantages than any other country are the unhappiest. I mean, how is it that the superpower with supposedly the best science and medicine in the world is also the one that lost the most people to COVID, that are losing the most people to this monkeypox thing? Now we got polio in the sewers. We've got $7 gas. You know, oh yeah. And Biden administration keeps trying to beat the drum about, well, it's gone down 80 cents over the last month. Yeah, bro. But it was also, we've never seen gas this high. So that's nothing to brag about. And anyway, I just put this out there because I implore all of you, don't think of me as a right winger or a left winger or anything. I'm just a guy that I believe in the Constitution. I believe in the Declaration of Independence. I think that's pretty freaking rock and roll, man. I think complying is anti-rock and roll. I think being afraid all the time and going along with whatever the television tells you just because it suits your own personal ideology and your distaste for a former president is pretty lame. And I would challenge you to rethink that. Hey, man, I'm going to be wrong about some things. And hopefully when I'm wrong and I say something wrong on the show, I will correct it in future shows. I'm not just going to sit by and act like, well, you know what? That's the information we had at the time. And since it was wrong and I told you that, I'm just going to let it go. No, I'm going to try to correct it. And I would say that all of us could stand to look at things that way. I read something yesterday that said, my personal hero in politics is Ron Paul. And he's just this guy from Texas that's delivered 15,000 babies. Did you know that about Ron Paul? Yeah, that's what he did. He delivered 15,000 babies. And he was kind of the black sheep of the Republican Party when, in fact, he should have been president. And his ideas are suddenly becoming popular again. Well, you know what? Truth, freedom, equality in a real sense, not a specialized hyper sense, that's always going to be popular. Private property, privacy, law and order, non-intervention. I'm not saying being a pacifist, but only intervene when it really matters, when it's really going to amount to something. Don't just wreck the joint, then walk away. And we also, you know, our forefathers said no foreign entanglements. Well, we've not done very well with that. I just bring this up because I think that when, for me, when I'm questioning things, I go, what would Ron Paul do? And I don't always agree with the guy, but when I don't agree with him, I find it interesting and I learn from it. Anyway, that's just my little rant for today. I really do appreciate getting to talk to all of you. I do hope that one day we sort all this out and that we get the hyper focus of all these things that divide us out of the picture. My name is Michael Parker. This is the program on TNT. Thank you, TNT, for the platform. Thank you, Dave and Alex, for keeping the trains on time. And thank you to the audience for being here. I'll see you tomorrow.